From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Last week, two Democratic legislators unveiled an outline of what they are calling a Green New Deal, an ambitious, some would say unrealistic, proposal to eliminate all U.S. carbon emissions and transform the economy.
Even the solutions that we have considered big and bold are nowhere near the scale of the actual problem that climate change presents.
That was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the plan's lead backers. Coming up, we'll talk with one of her economic advisors. Then later in the hour, Oakland singer-songwriter Fantastic Negrito will join us to talk about his Grammy win last night. It's all next after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump is mocking it on Twitter. Democratic 2020 presidential candidates are rushing to embrace it. But what's really in the Green New Deal? On Thursday, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Edward J. Markey, both Democrats, released an outline of the ambitious plan, which they say will stimulate the economy while addressing the urgent challenge of climate change. It calls for major increases in renewables and for the United States to become carbon neutral in 10 years. But so far, the plan consists of an unbinding resolution containing few specifics on how to reach those goals or how to pay for it all. Joining us to talk about the economics of the Green New Deal is Robert Hockett. He's professor of law and finance at Cornell University and an advisor to Representative Ocasio-Cortez. What questions do you have? You can call us now at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. The number to call, 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. And welcome, Robert Hockett. Good to have you aboard.
Oh, thanks so much. I listen to you guys pretty often, and it's just a joy to be on your program.
Well, delighted to have you here with us, and perhaps you can give us a primer on the Green New Deal. We would appreciate that. Let me begin by saying that the Green New Deal, contrary to, I think, a lot of misinformation, does not necessarily stem from Representative Ocasio-Cortez. It actually goes back here to San Francisco. San Francisco Chronicle reported on a conference, an environmental conference. I just wanted to mention that in light of the fact that it has had some longevity to it. It was mentioned by President Obama. It was also mentioned by Tom Friedman in 2017. But let's get into the basics with you, Professor. And,
sure.
And let's begin by talking about what it is as opposed to what it isn't. It's a resolution. It's a proposal. It's a really progressive agenda. But at this point, we've got pretty much an outline.
That's about right. I mean, we take the analogy to the original New Deal quite seriously. And the thing that I think maybe some people forget or don't know about the New Deal now that it's a bit distant past and people don't read all the history books anymore about it, is it actually unfolded over about a 10 to 12 year period, right? It was an organically growing sort of set of initiatives that actually comprised a good many statutes that were enacted over the course of years. So you sort of have to open with a kind of an opening gambit with a statement of broad principle and broad aspiration. And, of course, a statement of urgency, sort of explain why it's important, why it's critically important. So, in effect, Representative Ocasio-Cortez, along with many colleagues in the House and in the Senate now, have sort of made that opening move. They've said, okay, let's do this, as it were. And the first the resolution is effectively that sort of statement. The other thing that it is it provides kind of a list of important desiderata that we believe any Green New Deal ought to include, ideally. And so it can be viewed as a kind of a rough sort of a measuring rod against which to sort of measure our progress going forward with more specific initiatives henceforth.
Well, this is calling for really the most potential transformative project that we have seen since FDR's New Deal, but also since the early mobilizing for the Second World War. And there are a great number of dimensions to it, as well as a lot of details. But we're talking largely about, let me just see if we can get the basics here. We're talking about stopping fossil fuel energy, at least, you know, diminishing it to a great extent and going to renewables. Also healthcare for all and also jobs and jobs that are well-paying and productive. You know, it sounds to many like a wish list.
Well, It's a wish list, but it's also an intention list, right? We believe that these are all critical initiatives to take. Something maybe that's also worth noting in this connection is you might recall reading at some point that FDR, shortly before he died, had announced his intention to pursue what he called a second Bill of Rights. And the second Bill of Rights included essentially the sorts of social improvement measures that we're hoping to include in the Green New Deal, right? So that includes, right, guaranteed employment to those who are ready to work or who wish to work. It includes access to single-payer national health insurance of the kind that all the other developed countries have. It includes access to education, higher education, and continuing education in ways that don't bankrupt people or, you know, sort of send them to the poorhouse or leave them sort of so deeply in debt for the rest of their lives that they can't start new businesses or move to new places or, you know, sort of move forward in their lives. So in that sense, right, I mean, the second Bill of Rights of FDR was meant to be itself to be a kind of a continuation and culmination of the original New Deal. And we view ourselves as essentially trying to sort of pick up the mantle where he left it, carry his original New Deal forward in the ways that he intended to do, but then also while we're at it, of course, modernize the economy to clean technologies of a sort that we're able to produce now that we, of course, weren't on the horizon back in the 1940s.
Modernizing the economy as well as decentralizing the entire economy, right?
Yes and no. So we think, you know, there are certain things that have to be coordinated at a national level, just as in the New Deal itself, just as in the Constitution itself, which of course apportions roles to the federal government and to the states. But then there are other things that can be coordinated at the state level and yet other things that can be coordinated at local levels. One really key point, a key sort of desideratum that all of us have, I believe, is we really want the Green New Deal to have programs in literally every congressional district in the country. We want this really to work for literally everybody. And we don't think that's pie in the sky. We think that's sort of democracy, right? We really want this to work for every American, not just for this interest or that interest, not just for this locality or that locality, but for literally every single American.
And yet the sort of pushback, especially as coming from Republicans, is this is not only pie in the sky, this is massive boondoggle, and it's probably, from their perspective, nothing short of socialism.
Well, I mean, I've certainly seen that meme around. I don't know that all Republicans think that way, and I don't know that all of those on the right think that way. In fact, my guess would be that a good many sort of populist-oriented folk who were maybe Bernie Sanders supporters in 2015 and early 2016 and then maybe flipped over to supporting Mr. Trump once the general election came because he tried to speak to some of the same constituencies to which Bernie spoke might actually like the idea once they have a look at what we really have in mind. At the moment, of course, as you know, there are all sorts of memes out there and sort of representations of what it probably is or what it really is. And many of those, of course, are not accurate. And the best way, I think, to get an idea as to what it's really about is to read the resolution itself, which is, of course, now out on the web. We don't think there's any sense in which it's socialistic, at least no sense in which we aren't already socialistic in the sense that, again, the federal government often works to sort of help to sort of facilitate new developments, to facilitate sort of the jump-starting of new industries or sort of making sure that venture capital can get to new firms or small businesses. This is, of course, what the Small Business Administration does. Many things that we're familiar with today were originally the product of some sort of government support for the initial research or the initial sort of proofs of concept. I mean, the iPhone, for example, is just chock full of sort of critical technologies that were originally developed by or were financed in the developing by the federal government.
We have a whole, by the way, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the Green New Deal with Robert Hockett. He's professor of law and finance at Cornell and advisor to Democratic Representative Ocasio-Cortez from New York. We're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I just wanted also to get into some of the specifics with you, Professor Hockett, because
sure.
There's a whole portfolio, really, of, well, investment projects, and a lot of
yes.
them have to do with transportation, with ownership in the community. I mean, there's a lot to sort through here, but I think if we could get to the heart of it, we're talking about moving away from the power grids and electricity and maybe even moving away from traditional means of transportation and certainly nuclear energy, which is clean, but nevertheless, a lot of these things really mean a quantum jump and they mean a lot of money.
Right. So they do represent quantum jumps, and they do require significant investment, but that's, you know, not new either, right? That's a fairly familiar fact of development in general, right? So the United States economically developed in the first place with a great deal of support from the federal government during the period of Alexander Hamilton's tenure at the Treasury Department as our first Treasury Secretary. A big part of the national development that occurred over the course of the 19th century was also sort of federally assisted in various ways. And then, of course, all throughout the 20th and 21st century. You know, one sort of vision that animates the Green New Deal, I think it's certainly a vision that I have, and I suspect that most of my sort of teammates on this share it, is that development is never finished. You know what I mean? There's a tendency for us to think of national development as something you do as you sort of take off from, you know, an economically backward state. And then once you're there and that's it. We think of development really as a kind of a lifelong thing for a nation, right? A nation never really stops developing. And that's, of course, because technologies never stop developing and economies never stop developing. So, you know, we're in some ways, our country is falling behind when it comes to the sorts of infrastructures that we use and on which our economy is built. And all nations try to have modern infrastructures as part of continuing development and continued sort of keeping pace or continued staying modern. And again, in all of these cases, there are roles that are proper for individuals. There are roles that are proper for firms. There are roles that are proper for municipalities and localities, others for states, and then others, of course, for the federal government. In general, the more coordination that's required, the higher the level of organization that's required. So if you're talking about a national grid or a national transportation system, of course the federal government should be involved. If, on the other hand, you're talking about a kind of a local transportation system within the national one, then of course you're talking about local government or state government. And, you know, sort of similarly with a lot of the technologies that we're thinking about, many of these are being developed already, right, by private firms, and others indeed have been developed by private firms. But oftentimes a private firm can't take a risk or can't place a bet on something that's going to be transformative because it has to assume or it has to rely on other people to adopt the same technology or the same standards. And that's where coordination of standards and standard setting comes in. And that's, again, where a higher level of organization like a state government or the federal government comes in.
And you're talking about a good deal of coordination as well as partnerships with industry and with farmers and so forth.
Exactly. And again, that's the way we've always done it. I think it's really important maybe for people to know this. There's a kind of maybe a popular misconception held by some that the private sector is just simply private and there's no sort of public involvement or facilitation at all, and that the public sector is just the public sector and doesn't have anything to do with the private. But our country has always been a kind of hybrid. Our economy has always been a kind of hybrid economy where the public acts to facilitate the private. And that doesn't mean crowding out the private. It doesn't mean, you know, sort of replacing the private. It means doing the kind of coordinating stuff that only a collective agent acting on behalf of the entire citizenry can do, so that then once that framework is in place, all kinds of individual actions are made possible that wouldn't otherwise be made possible. And that's a sense in which, by the way, federal involvement actually enhances our freedoms, at least if we think of freedoms as rooms to maneuver or as, you know, capacities to make choices or as having menu options, as it were. That's often made possible by the putting in place of a framework. And that's something that the citizenry as a whole has to do. And the way the citizenry as a whole does this sort of thing is through its highest level of organization, which is its federal government.
We're going to talk more about the Green New Deal, and we're going to go to your calls here in just a moment. I just want to get one other thing on the board here with you, Professor Hockett, and that is there's a lot of rhetoric and language about protecting historically, well, underserved or wronged communities. That word wrong comes in from time to time. Can you give us what the sketch is and the outline there?
Yeah, sure. So the basic idea here is you if we start, so again, this will be elaborated over probably a 10-year period or so, just like the real New Deal, right? It's an organic work in progress to which everybody can contribute their ideas, their thoughts, their labors, and so forth. So as this thing is kind of going forward, the question comes, arises, you know, sort of where do you begin, right? How do you sequence things? Where do you start? And our thought is that you get a lot more bang for the buck at the front end if you start in areas that are especially underserved by infrastructures or technologies. And as it happens, those areas that have been most sort of dramatically underserved by infrastructures and technologies also happen to be places that have been historically disadvantaged in other ways, either for ethnic reasons or for reasons of having been sort of left behind by the economy as it developed in one direction or another. If you take, for example, Flint, Michigan as a case in point, right, the water infrastructure in Flint, Michigan was just, of course, deplorable, right? It was just a disaster, and that's why, of course, all these horrible things have happened there. It also happens, of course, to be an ethnically concentrated community that's not basically a bunch of middle-class white folk, right? It's predominantly African-American and predominantly lower income. So, you know, if you sort of pay special attention to those areas that have recently or even more than recently been historically underserved, if you go there first, you get a lot of bang for the buck in the sense that you make enormous quantum leaps forward by, you know, restoring or even just putting in place modern infrastructure there. But having said that, I want to emphasize, this is not about sort of especially targeting in any kind of, sole way or only way or exclusive way particular communities. That's a matter of sort of where you start or where you get the most bang for the buck at the front end. But again, the real plan here is to literally to serve literally every community in the nation.
Talking with Robert Hockick, professor of law and finance at Cornell. Let me go to your calls, and let's begin with Asa. Asa, I guess, huh?
Asa, sorry. So I have two quick questions. The first one goes more towards the political landscape in terms of you have a lot of presidential candidates rushing to endorse this, but at the same time you have party leadership like Nancy Pelosi being dismissive of the concept and even calling it a dream herself. Maybe getting the name mixed up, but kind of what you were talking about with the GOP call it, where it was pie in the sky. So that question in terms of what your thoughts in terms of that, is it something that's likely going to happen if party leadership like Pelosi doesn't really seem to be on board with it? The second one was about the decentralization piece, where a part of the conversation we haven't really seen was in terms of the scale of national security by decentralizing our electricity grid, so that it's less susceptible to, exterior, maybe cyber attacks or anything like that, that taking out one grid takes out the entire eastern seaboard versus taking off one grid takes off a town kind of thing. So I'm curious of what where the national security piece fits into the Green New Deal as well. And I'll take
sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those questions, Asa. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, thanks so much, Asa. So first on the politics of it, we don't actually take the speaker's use of the word dream as having been meant as a sort of a slight or as a sort of a pejorative. Of course, we talk about the American dream all the time, and we're thinking of the Green New Deal actually as a kind of furthering of the American dream, which, as you know, has been in a state of some disrepair of late with the current generation of sort of young adults in America being the first in our history, as I understand it, to have prospects that look to be rather bleaker than those of their parents. So we think one reason that the American dream itself has been a little bit more difficult for people to fulfill of late is precisely because we haven't acted together as a full citizenry to modernize our economy in a way that provides opportunity for everybody to prosper and indeed to work hard and create and make and build and to sort of profit by doing so. We actually think that the speaker is fine with this, but she of course has to be kind of moderating in what she says, because she's got a very large caucus to deal with, and she's got on the one hand rather progressive Democrats in her caucus, and on the other hand she has some who have had to be a little bit more traditionally conservative, maybe owing to the districts in which they live or maybe just because of their age cohort and when they got elected or what have you. So we think she's being basically just kind of an honest broker or sort of neutral about this and not really slagging us. More broadly speaking about the politics, we actually do think the politics are good for this once everybody actually knows what we have in mind and aren't sort of maybe misled by any mischaracterizations or any sort of false assimilations between what we have in mind on the one hand and
well, Professor Hockett, before
policy
we,
used to sound like.
I was just going to say, before we get to decentralization, which was also raised by the caller, I'm looking at a comment here from David who says, he's talking about messaging, and I think in terms of politics, that's central. He says, while the vision of the Green New Deal is fantastic and desperately needed, it feels like promoting this makes the Democrats look like they are going off half-cocked. This is another example of the Democrats not thinking about messaging.
I don't think. I mean, I'm not. It's not clear to me where what the basis of or what the example he has in mind is when he writes that. If the idea is that it's half cocked because it's merely a resolution and it's a broad statement of aspirations, I don't think it's right then, right? Because it's fully cocked. It's just that this was the shot that we intended to fire, so to speak, at this particular juncture. Because again, everybody has to remember, this is going to be an organically growing whole, a sort of a direction of national movement over a decade, in the same way that the original New Deal itself was. Do you want me to
let's go to decentralization, though, because the caller raised it. I think it's an important part of this. Maybe part of the messaging comes down, or the politics comes down, to the fact that that word socialism keeps coming up from the right.
Right. So, yeah. So on then to Asa's second point. So as far as decentralization goes, I mean, I think that what Asa was referencing is the idea of redundancy within systems, right? The idea that you have a system that is resilient owing to various redundancies, such that if some part of it is taken out or sort of shuts down or is damaged by some terrible storm or what have you, there are sort of replacement capillary systems, so to speak, through which the blood can continue to flow. And that, of course, will be part of the full plan. That's just basic common sense logistics, I think. Any, proper grid system, whether it be an energy grid or power grid or even just a communications grid, should be built with that form of resiliency in mind. And we definitely have that in mind. But note, tying that back then to the idea of centralization as such, or decentralization, or so-called socialism. Again, we don't think that these are either ors, right? The key word that Americans ought to think about in this connection is a word that the Europeans sometimes use. It's called subsidiarity. In America, we usually refer to it as federalism, but it's basically the same idea. The idea here is, again, the greater the degree of coordination that's required for something, the higher the level of organization that has to deal with it. The lower the degree of coordination that's required, the more local, right, the level of organization can be, right? So when it comes to sort of establishing national standards, for example, that makes sense to do at the federal level. And if when it comes to sort of seeing to it that loss of power in one area can be dealt with by a sudden channeling of power from another area, that too is a case of sort of inter-regional or inter-locality coordinating, which requires that we coordinate as citizens at a higher level of government. If, on the other hand, we're talking about just literally what's done in San Francisco or what's done in Ithaca, New York, then, of course, we're talking about stuff that should be and will be and can be handled at the local level, where people are more responsive to local conditions and indeed are more aware in a very visceral way of what local conditions are.
We're coming up close on a break, but I want to get Nathan in here. Nathan wants to talk about nuclear power, which I alluded to. Nathan, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Big fan of the show. So a common question about nuclear power, the question is why nuclear power is being de-emphasized by this Green New Deal, and some commentary around it. Of course, nuclear power, is emissions-free, and really the only benchmark that we have in the world of other countries really cutting down their carbon emissions is through the creation of nuclear power, such as in European countries like France and Germany.
Yeah, that's an important question. Over... Nathan, we're coming up on a break. I'd like to get Professor Hackett to respond quickly, if you could, Professor.
Oh, right now, before the break?
You want to wait till the break is over? All right.
A really quick response now is, we're open to lots of different possibilities. We're trying not to rule certain things out at this point. What we're really more about at the moment is expanding the menu and adding optionality, if I can put it that way.
It says no nuclear power, though, in terms of what I read, doesn't it, at this point? We'll come back to that.
Yeah, let's come back to that.
And we'll come back to more of your calls, so stay on the line. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Professor Robert Hackett. He's professor of law and finance at Cornell University, talking about the Green New Deal. And if you'd like to join us, you can do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or post your comments on our website at kqed.org/forum or on Facebook. And you can also tweet us at KQED Forum or email us forum@kqed.org. And Professor Ackett, when we went to the break, we were talking about nuclear power, and my understanding is, and this is, I suppose, made a lot of people who believe nuclear power is indeed clean energy. We should be moving, like the caller said, more toward that, like in France and Israel and other European countries. The proposal sort of says we need to move away, says pretty significantly move away from nuclear power, doesn't it?
Right. Well, so now that I have a couple more minutes to chat about it, maybe the best thing, the best way to address it is to sort of, again, think in terms of that sort of long temporal extension of the unrolling of the Green New Deal, the sort of phasing in of it. So now the end state, right, in the long run, what we really want to arrive at is a case where as much of our power is supplied by renewable sources as possible. Nuclear, strictly speaking, isn't considered, of course, a renewable, and we want ultimately to be there and not to have to use things like nuclear. On the other hand, on the way there, right, we're talking about basically a building out of the capacity to use renewables. We're not talking about then sort of immediately eliminating things or ruling things out or prohibiting things or regulating against them or what have you. So our thought is the long-term goal here is to render, is to make there no, make it be the case that there's no longer a need for fossil fuel use or ultimately for nuclear power use either, but that we could all use renewable. But again, that has to be understood that that is the, that's the long-term end state. And on the way there, what we're talking about is adding optionality rather than, you know, prohibiting things or striking things off the menu. One last point on this, if I might, is I think another source maybe of some objection to the Green New Deal idea on some people's part when they don't quite understand fully what the Green New Deal idea is there might be a tendency to kind of assimilate it to previous environmental movements or previous environmental measures, which often did involve, right, capping and trading or prohibiting this or prohibiting that or regulating this or regulating that or taxing this or taxing that. And that's not really what this is about, right? That's the old form of environmental regulation. We don't have any particular gripe with it, but what we're trying to do is add something that hasn't been done before, which is, again, really to make a serious effort to grow that optionality out, such as to allow people essentially to migrate voluntarily from those older forms of power to newer forms of power.
That's a kind of incremental implementation, and I understand, you know, of course, if you can get the backing of the legislature, big questions like that loom, you'll move in an incremental way. But there's also a lot of talk about, you know, relying upon renewables and also perhaps not relying on air traffic, for example, which many people, of course, are totally reliant upon.
So that's there's another, I think, another sort of meme or misconception has kind of gotten out about that as well. So two things to say about that, right? So again, first, where there's a reference to air travel, the idea here is that when you add optionality of certain kinds, some air travel might no longer be as attractive to people as it is now. If you could actually get from New York to Chicago on a high-speed train as quickly as you could fly there, or, you know, taking account, of course, of going through the security lines and so forth at the airports, then many people would presumably move over to that mode of transportation, as has happened in Europe and in China. But that doesn't mean that we think that, oh, air travel is going to go away, and it certainly doesn't mean that we want to prevent air travel from happening or anything like that. Again, this is really about adding choices to our menu and not about taking away choices. The other thing is that it is true that in future it looks as though airplane fuels themselves might be increasingly biofuel type fuels. And there are other forms of power that are being experimented with and dealt with right now in connection with powering flight. Maybe one day those will be new ways of powering air travel. We're certainly, you know, we're cool with that if that turns out to be possible. But we don't want to, you know, be misread as saying, oh, we don't like air travel and therefore we want to phase it out. It's just about increasing our choices and optionality. If some things emerge once we do that that are better than what we now have, our thought is that people will use those anyway. Nothing has to be mandated. Nothing has to be prohibited.
All right. We're going to get some more calls on. And Phil, you're next. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. Great show. The point I want to make is the use of the word socialism. So the GOP is really jumping on all of this, saying that everybody wants to make things socialist. I was an econ major, and my understanding is that the definition of socialism is the public ownership of the means of production.
And distribution, really. I'd add, yeah.
And distribution, and nobody's talking about that. That's why Social Democrat is talked about. So what we're doing here is the words are not that accurate. What we're really talking about is the use of capitalism in order to maximize human benefit. So we like air traffic controllers, which is a socialized system, because it enhances our capitalist system. You know, the GOP is trying to deconstruct the entitlements, which is another dangerous word. And I see that this is trying to counter, you know, that, to try to bring humanity into our government. But we should be very careful about these words, because they're going to be used to skew these great objectives.
Well, Phil, I thank you for that caveat. I appreciate your thoughts. We're going to go to more of your calls in a moment. I'm going to read a comment first by Chris, who says, I'd love to hear your guest's thoughts on the 80 or so companies that are overwhelmingly responsible for global warming. How are we going to hold them accountable?
Great. So can I address Phil's question first?
Oh, sure. I was going to let it stand as a comment, but please go ahead.
Yeah, no, just a quick response. I think that's right. I mean, the word socialism seems to have almost as many meanings now as it has utterers, right? And, you know, the real question, it seems to me, is, again, what does it make sense for the citizens as a whole to coordinate? What does it make sense for smaller groupings of citizens, such as at the state level or local level, to coordinate? And then, of course, what does it make sense to have individuals or firms that individuals themselves all jointly constitute, coordinate something? And once you sort of get that right, you know, just you can call it whatever you want. I would just call it efficiency, right? You know, we have a national agricultural policy. Farmers benefit by it. Is that socialized agriculture? I wouldn't think so, and I doubt that many farmers would say that, right? And, you know, one could proliferate examples like that. So I think that Phil makes a very important point there. It's probably best to get away from some of these labels and just talk about the underlying arrangements and then debate whether we like the idea of this arrangement or that arrangement. With respect to the email, the companies that are sort of overwhelmingly responsible or what have you, we don't have a specific position on those firms, at least not yet. But there's a reason for that. It's not that we're trying to be wishy-washy or that, you know, we think everything's cool as it is and should be left. It's just that, you know, we really do believe that in order to change our infrastructure itself, you have to act at the national level. And as you gradually develop a new infrastructure that makes use of new technologies themselves, what you do is you afford plenty of positive incentive, right, rather than negative incentive, plenty of positive incentive for people to move over to these better and more efficient systems. And when I say people in that context, I also mean firms, right? So many companies that might profit right now by producing carbon-emitting technologies or carbon-emitting fuels might very well find it more profitable to move into non-carbon-emitting fuels or technologies once that kind of federal coordination is there. After all, you know, think about how we moved to petroleum, right? We moved to petroleum from coal. That wasn't just spontaneously done by a bunch of individual companies. Essentially, what we did is we set new national standards that sort of put the thumb on the scale in favor of the move to petroleum. It was largely done because the military decided that petroleum was a better fuel for it to use than coal. And that converted us from a coal economy to a petroleum. We're effectively saying that we ought to do something similar now as we sort of move toward other carbon-free, cleaner technologies. One last point in this connection, if I might, Michael, is that, you know, most of the technologies that we're referencing here were developed here in the States. These are American inventions. And now some of our competing countries, notably China, have become the world's largest producers and consumers and exporters of these very technologies. And they're making a killing doing it, dominating global markets in those technologies and in those industries, again, both in their use of them and in their exporting of them. We'd kind of like to put America out front there again, right? Not necessarily it has to be like we're number one or whatever, but we ought to be in the first rank of nations, if not indeed the first nation, to sort of be consuming, producing, and indeed exporting these technologies. Because again, we invented them. They were really ours in the first place. And it's sort of a shame that we're not the ones capitalizing on them.
All right, let me bring another caller aboard. And David, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I had a question. I'd like to know about the results in fighting climate change that this program is going to bring about. Right now, we're at 407 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Where are we going to be 10 years from now with this program, and how much is it going to cost, and how much will it prevent temperature from rising from today?
Very important questions, David, and I thank you for them. We're talking about a 10-year national mobilization. I know, Professor Hockett, and that's a pretty lofty goal in itself. But we're all, let's get into cost with you here, if we could.
Sure.
I mean, immediately people raise a red flag here of creating deficits that are out of. I mean, we're at them now, actually, with a party leadership that was always supposedly against or reducing deficits greatly. But the fact is, you're talking about money that would be comparable to, again, what was done during the mobilization of the Second World War and the kind of tax cut money that we saw in this administration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the key point to remember here, Michael, is that any national expenditure can be either in the form of pure sort of consumption or pure investment or something in between, right? The more investment-like it is essentially the more sort of net profit yielding, so to speak, or net income yielding it is, right? Now, the thing about the tax cuts over the last 15 years, which have amounted to somewhere around, I think, $5 trillion in total, if you rope in all of the Bush tax cuts and the most recent one by the Trump and Republican Congress back in December of 2017, and then you add in the war expenditures during the Bush years, you're talking somewhere, again, in the neighborhood of maybe $7 trillion or more dollars. None of these were productive in the sense that they didn't sort of stoke economic growth or real growth or the real production of goods and services. And so those could be thought of as sort of, in a way, wasteful, right? Imagine if, on the other hand, or if by contrast, we had invested that kind of money into an actual rationalizing of our national infrastructure, a rendering of it much more efficient. So you don't have cars backed up on highways emitting gas as they, you know, sit there in gridlock, where you don't have cars or trucks having their tires worn down every couple of days or something because the particular stretch of highway is completely degraded. You don't have transportation having to take all sorts of detours or people waiting in airports. Imagine the kind of productivity enhancements that these investments are going to bring. That's the first point to note. That can render these sorts of things, you know, on net actually positives rather than negatives. They can actually, in other words, yield more income than they end up taking. A related point is our view is that by doing this right, we can actually increase the employment rate in real, true, you know, good, life-sustaining, living wage-type jobs for so many Americans that many, many, many Americans are going to be earning money, much more money than they used to. And so the revenue take by the government would be much, much larger as well, right? The tax base, in other words, would increase enormously. Final point maybe to make here quickly, Michael, is that in general, it's not deficits themselves that matter or even deficits as a percentage of GDP that matters. What we really worry about when we talk, what people are really worried about when they talk about deficits is the possibility of longer-term inflation or high borrowing costs or both, right? But the thing is, you know, what's sort of interesting is even the wasteful expenditures of the last 15 years, the giant tax cuts and the war expenditures didn't themselves cause any noticeable inflation out there in the consumer goods or products markets or services markets. And again, those weren't particularly productive investments, right? Those were just expenditures. If you actually had productive investments being made of the sort that we're talking about, then you have an immense boost to the productive capacity of the economy. That means that the goods and services supply grows with the money supply. And as you know, right, inflation is a relation, right? You have inflation when there's too much money chasing too few goods. You have a deflation when there's too little money with too many goods. What you really want to do is keep those things in sync, goods and services on the one hand, money supply on the other. If you do the investing right, as the Green New Deal aims to do, you're actually increasing the quantum of goods and services at the same time that you're increasing the money supply. That keeps them in sync. That prevents any sort of inflation.
Quick tweet from Lanny. He wants to know which version of the Green New Deal we're talking about or is supposed to read. The original, he says, was released to NPR and posted on the web. And now Representative Ocasio-Cortez says that was the wrong one, or is there some other version?
There is no other version. There was an FAQ, apparently. As I understand it, there was a frequently asked questions document that had been sort of circulated back and forth between various congressional offices, and there were a number of, you know, proposed drafts. And my understanding is that the one that was originally sent out was one of those drafts rather than the original one. As soon as the mistake was discovered, it was corrected. It was taken down. I think notices were sent out to various people who had received the wrong document. document telling them, but I don't know for sure. I guess you'd have to talk to the office itself about the details there. But what I do know is that that FAQ was not the definitive FAQ. And secondly, even if it had been the definitive one, the FAQ is not the resolution, right? That's the thing to look at. When we talk about the Green New Deal right now, we're talking about the Green New Deal resolution, the one that was signed on to by over 60 House members and by, I think, 8-9 senators maybe, including most, if not all, of the Democratic candidates for president. That's the document, right? And that's up on the web, and it's easy to access. There's no other version that's relevant here.
And here's another caller. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I want to thank you first for devoting your life and your energy towards this. I don't think there's anything more important.
Thanks so much.
I'm a regenerative land designer with a day job as a landscaper. And there's a lot of talk in my community about drawdown. And so when I think of something with an ambitious title as Green New Deal, you have to forgive me. I'm in the middle of my work.
Oh, no worries. Take your time and don't endanger yourself, please.
Right. I think of drawdown. I don't think there's anything more on the table than carbon capture and tabling the release of carbon. And so there's nothing more prevalent than farming. Agriculture is what builds our communities. And so with the advent of the Natural Resources Conservation Service from FDR, there were a lot of things put into place for access to farmland for farmers. And I'd like to see that again. And I just wonder if that's being talked about at all. And I see so much potential in carbon drawdown in our soils and regenerative farming that it just feels like it should be up there with transportation and fossil fuel productivity. And that's it. I can take my...
Yeah, no, I'm glad that we have that question out there, and I thank you for it. Not only there are a lot of people raising questions about what's not in the Green New Deal. He's brought up soil. I'm looking at something from Charles who says, why is there so little in the Green New Deal for urban development, creating walkable cities, reducing sprawl, improving local public transit, and increasing infill? Is the answer to those kind of questions the fact that, you know, you can just be comprehensive up to a certain degree, and then you run into, obstacles of being too comprehensive or not comprehensive?
Well, so you know, whatever the obstacles to being too or not enough might be, I can certainly say definitively at this point, we don't intend to omit any of these proposals or these suggestions, right? Drawdown or, you know, sort of urban space renewal, things of that sort, you know, sort of smart cities. All of that stuff we think of as being sort of on the table. Here's maybe a way to think about what we have in mind that kind of connects up with what I said at the outset, but also sort of further elaborates it. So remember I noted that one way to think about this is just like the original New Deal. It's going to be an organically developing whole over the course of 10 years. And that means that everybody who's interested in making this come out right has a place at the table to sort of contribute at the local level, at state levels, at national levels, you know, industry groups, other community groups, environmental groups, or what have you. Everything is kind of, in a certain sense, up for discussion, because what we're really trying to do is to launch a national deliberation about how to move forward. In a way, you can analogize this to Representative Ocasio-Cortez's sort of mode of operating as a congresswoman herself already, right? So you remember that wonderful first week that she took office and she was going to be sworn in, she basically Instagrammed and tweeted and sort of basically brought all of her constituents into the process by constantly sort of capturing it all on her phone and then posting it right away so that everybody would be sort of participating, all of her constituents would be participating in her orientation to Congress and her swearing in and so forth. You can think of the Green New Deal in a similar way. We really literally want this to be a case where the entire constituency, which is in this case, of course, the entire national population, is taking part in the deliberation, the sort of the mass group thought or the mass kind of mind meld, as it were, where we're all talking together and discussing what this should look like so that as it unfolds over the coming 10 years, it is maximally informed and is maximally democratic. And so I think that the city ideas, the ways for sort of improving urban spaces and rationalizing urban design and power use and housing development or arrangements of housing, all of that is a critically important part of this. We don't mean to omit that at all. We think of that as really crucial. That, of course, will come into it in the big national discussion that we want to initiate and get underway. Similarly with drawdown, right? So there's, of course, a big controversy among environmentalists about whether drawdown is a bad idea or a good idea. Apparently, those who fear the idea think that it might make people go ahead and emit more if they think it can just be drawn down anyway. Apparently, those who think it's a good idea think, well, why don't we want to cleanse things? We're not, you know, sort of dogmatically committed to a particular position in that controversy. We are, however, dogmatically committed to the proposition that this ought to be part of a big public discussion now and not just a discussion among environmentalists. This is our destiny now. We're really talking about the future of our country and our planet. We've got 10 or 12 years, according to NASA, right, really to get this thing under wraps before we reach some kind of a tipping point where it's virtually impossible to reverse the damage that's being done.
I'm coming up on another quick break here, but I wanted to ask you actually a question from a listener named Tom, who says, how is the Green New Deal different from what President Obama did in regard to investing in green industries and the promise of new jobs as the outcome? If it wasn't successful at that scale, how can you predict it being successful at a much larger scale?
Two answers. First, we actually think larger scale is what's required to make it work, right? In other words, there are some things out there that if you go small, if you lowball it or slow walk it, you actually make it less likely to succeed because you have to do things at the appropriate scale, right? That's the first point. And so that's why we're really talking about something like the New Deal itself.
Quick to the second point, if you could, Professor.
Yeah, massive national mobilization. Remind me, I'm sorry, the second point. I just lost it.
All right, well, let me do this because we were going to have a Grammy segment. We're going to have to postpone it, and I wanted the listeners to know about that. Also wanted them to know that this is a period where we are asking your support. It's a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And have you captured that second point? If not, I'll just go to some more comments.
I forgot the second point, Michael. I'm sorry. Could you remind me really quickly?
That's all right. It was your second point. I'm not a mind reader, but I'll go to another caller here.
Oh, we'll it was my Andrew. Second point. Oh, gosh, that's right. Yeah, I said I have two points.
That was your second point.
I lost it. Sorry, sir.
We'll find it maybe.
Oh,
as we...
second point. No. Ah, I'm sorry. I do. It was the politics, right? Remember that President Obama was dealing with a hostile Congress in both houses, right, in both Senate and the House. And we're thinking, you know, we're obviously banking on, you know, having more national unity going forward, especially starting in 2021.
And here's Andrew. Andrew, join us.
Yes. Hi. I wanted to ask quickly whether or not the Green New Deal puts an emphasis on carbon taxes as opposed to exclusively income taxes. I think there were some elements of the Republican Party that were exploring the potential for carbon taxes and sort of drowned out by the Trump administration. But I'm curious what emphasis will be put on this, because clearly we need to tax directly the thing that's causing the problem and not just income, although both could be used in tandem, I would imagine.
Yeah. So again, I think that the answer to that, you know, the answer to the question how much emphasis will be put on this is sort of pending. It really sort of depends on what the national conversation that we're trying to initiate becomes, right? Now, of course, for exactly the reasons you allude to, a lot of people are going to suggest that carbon taxation be a big part of a plan, especially if we're trying to kind of incentivize certain kinds of activity or disincentivize certain kinds of activity. But there are others who are going to say, well, instead of doing that, what we really ought to do is invest in a more kind of proactive, affirmative way to provide alternatives so that people actually have less reason or find it less interesting to engage in sort of carbon emission anyway, even apart from taxation. The latter strategy we think would be sort of optimal, but if it's not feasible, then of course we'd have to think of other things. But all of that is sort of for the discussion going forward, because again, it's not a done – the Green New Deal isn't a done deal. It's actually just a deal that's only now beginning. And what the ultimate deal ends up being is going to be the product of this big national public deliberation that we're hoping to launch with the launch of the resolution last Thursday.
What about getting the legislators? I mean, so many legislators are under real pressure, particularly where money is coming from and money is going into their coffers, and they're being influenced away from a lot of things, frankly, that are in this Green New Deal.
Yeah. So a great thing about the original New Deal is that it had projects in literally every congressional district of the country, right? And that was both, I think, democratically proper and politically savvy, right? It's savvy for the obvious reason that Congress members like things that help their districts. That's one way in which that's one thing that enables military expenditure to work so well, right? As at least politically speaking, right? But it's also democratically important, and that's the democratic importance of it to us is of much greater importance than the political savviness importance of it. We actually think every American has a right to benefit by this big national mobilization, right? When we mobilized for the Second World War, that was the last massive mobilization we've ever done. The idea was literally to defend the entire country, every single person. And of course, we had factories building, putting out planes and tanks and ships and so forth all over the country. We want to do that the same thing now, except that now instead of, you know, mass manufacturing lots of instruments of war and so forth, since there isn't a world war underway, thank God, you know, really to sort of mobilize to sort of defend our planet and our country from what you might think of as what William James called the moral equivalent of war. And that is, of course, the destruction of the planet. So we want every citizen in every community to be benefiting by this. That makes it democratically proper, and it also, as it happens, as a sort of a side benefit, makes it politically, I think, more popular.
Let's hear next from Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann, you're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. What I wanted to ask, I admittedly don't know, is if there's anything in the Green New Deal that addresses big agriculture and the impact of that has.
So we do talk in the aspirational document that is the resolution about modernizing agriculture as well in ways that are much more environmentally friendly. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, sort of coming down on agribusinesses or coming down on this kind of technology or that. What it means here is what it does in other sort of sectors of the economy that I was sort of referencing earlier as well, and that is providing greater optionality in all sectors of the economy, including the agricultural, so that it actually becomes possible and indeed cost-effective for people voluntarily to transition to better technologies and better methods.
We'll have to leave it there. Robert Hockett, good to have you with us, and much appreciated.
So good, Michael. Thanks.
Robert Hockett is professor of law and finance at Cornell. He's an advisor to Representative Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, and we have another hour up ahead. We're going to talk with Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. That's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.